listening to Knowing Faith, a podcast of Training the Church.
This is Kyle Worley, and I'm joined by my co-host Jen Wilkin and JT English. And today we are also joined by Dr. Rebecca McLaughlin. Rebecca has her PhD in Renaissance Literature. She is a speaker. She's the author of Confronting Christianity, 12 Hard Questions for the World's Largest Religion, which is absolutely excellent. If you haven't read it, you need to go buy it. You need to read it. It'd be a great winter read. And she has some forthcoming books coming out, 10 Questions Every Teen Should Ask and Answer About Christianity, and The Secular Creed, Engaging 5 Contemporary Claims. That one's coming out in April. Rebecca, we're so glad to have you on the show.
I'm delighted to be here.
Oh my goodness, we're so excited. You know, you and I have done a video call before, and included in that video call was one of the more embarrassing moments of my ministry ever.
Yeah, so I was trying to expound God's love in the midst of sacrifice and in the midst of suffering in our world. And I was really kind of getting into my flow. And suddenly I realized I've been muted by my host. I thought, oh no, what did I say?
It was so, Rebecca, it was like, I'm not over communicating this. It was one of the more climactic and gospel rooted moments of the whole thing. She's like really, really getting at this incredible, because the question was, where's the good God in the midst of a pandemic? And Rebecca had been addressing our people, and lots of people were on this call. It was right at the beginning of the pandemic. Interest was high, and she was doing such a great job. And I accidentally muted her right at the moment.
Yeah. Of like, it was accidental.
Yeah.
Like, for how long?
Really think about women speaking on theology.
Are we talking like 5 seconds, 10 seconds?
I mean, it was probably 10 or 12 seconds, I would imagine. Because I didn't realize my error. Somebody in Zoom world, somebody had just joined the call and their mic was not muted and it was making sound. And I went to click on to mute their mic, but like the positions of the little icons change. And I, when I clicked, from the moment I thought I need to mute this person's mic and I clicked, to the moment I clicked, the profile changed over and it was now Rebecca.
This is a story and he's sticking to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We should do an episode of like top 10 most public, you know, ministry embarrassing moments for Kyle. Can we do something like that?
We all have them.
No,
I'm not unique in this.
You proliferate them. Yeah.
I do. I don't know what it is. A fool is drawn to folly, I guess. But listen, this season we're exploring Genesis 1 through 11. And today I wanted to have Rebecca on to talk about how to handle hard questions that may come up with others when studying, reading, or discussing Genesis. Because Rebecca has written, not on Genesis in particular, although she's addressed it in her book, and I'm sure we'll address it in other writing work that she does in the future, because it's kind of an unavoidable book when dealing with the scope of the Bible. But she has definitely spent time talking through how to address hard questions, not just in the details of specific questions, but how to be the kind of person who can address them in a righteous and holy and courageous and humble way. And so Genesis 1 through 11, you don't have to read very much of Genesis 1 through 11 to find yourself grappling with some hard questions. And if you're engaging with somebody about the Christian faith, it's not uncommon for hard questions they have about the Christian faith to be rooted in some of the story and passages and truth that we find in Genesis 1 through 11. So let's start at like the highest level possible here, Rebecca. What do we do when someone asks us a hard question about Genesis or about something else in the Bible and we just don't know the answer?
I think the truth is always a good place to start in any conversation as a Christian. So when that's happened to me, I have forced myself to say, and it's hard because I'm a proud person, I have forced myself to say, I don't know. Now, that's not necessarily all we have to say in that situation, because often even if we don't have the specific answer to that person's question and we want to say, you know, that's a really good question and I don't know that I have a great answer for you, there will often be other things that we can point them to from our own knowledge of the scriptures. So maybe it's, I don't know what's happening in this particular passage in the Old Testament. But what I do know is that the God of the whole Bible is the God who sent Jesus to the cross on our behalf.
Yeah.
And the God who brought hope out of that situation in the resurrection and offers us eternal life. It's not that there aren't going to be ways that we could go theologically, even when we feel like, oh, you know what? I honestly don't have a good answer to that. And I think also we can helpfully draw on the resources of other brothers and sisters to say, you know what, I don't know that I really have the expertise to answer this question of yours, but I've heard this really good book by Jen Wilkin or by somebody else who's actually done some more significant thinking. You know, I'd love to either read that and get back to you, or maybe we could read that together. There could be ways to actually turn that moment where we might feel like, gosh, we're really letting the Lord down because we don't have a good answer to this question. Actually, we could use that as an opportunity to show gospel humility, which sadly people don't often expect from Christians, and to invite people into a conversation.
I was going to say I'm having two simultaneous thoughts. The first is we should just throw out our entire next Q&A session. And the second is let's get Rebecca to answer all the questions the next time we do a Q&A session. I'm curious how, I know you have a PhD in literature. And so I'm curious, as someone who my training per se that I bring to bear on the way that I approach the scriptures is related to having an English degree, not even a master's, just a BA. But I'm wondering how much of your thinking around, how to utilize the scriptures with regard to answering questions. Like, I'm curious how your training in literature relates to the way that you handle the scriptures.
That's a great question.
I think one of the huge mistakes that we, particularly honestly as evangelical Christians, have made in the last several decades is not helping people to properly understand the difference, that the true and literal are not the same thing, that they're not kind of interchangeable words. And I think, I mean, you see it even in surveys that people do of pastor opinions, and they say, hey, which of these do you agree with? The Bible is the word of God and should be taken literally in every case. Mm-hmm. That's number one, which shows your highest level of commitment to the Bible. The second might be, you know, the Bible is the word of God, but shouldn't always be taken literally. And that's sort of seen as a less faithful way of relating to the Bible. Actually, we only have to look at the words of Jesus himself to see that Jesus uses metaphors all day long. And that often his most important and sometimes his hardest teachings are communicated to us in a metaphor.
Yeah.
So I think for me, having done a PhD that was on prison metaphors in Shakespeare, one of the sensibilities that I always bring to the scriptures is to say, hey, let's look for the metaphors. And let's remember that actually a truth enclosed in a metaphor can be at least as true as a truth communicated in literal language. And in fact, it can be true in a way that draws our hearts more than literal truth does. And even to add to that, if the God of the Bible is the God who actually made us in the first place, then while I might look for a metaphor and sort of look around me and think, okay, what is like what? Maybe A is like B. I'll compare those two. God can actually create things in order for them to be metaphors to help us understand how he loves us and who he is. So I think reclaiming the truth value of metaphors as we approach the scriptures is incredibly important and will help us to not get stuck on, oh, well, I always have to assume that the quite literal reading is necessarily the most faithful reading when often it's definitely not.
How many of the hard questions that people come to you with are related to that issue? How often are they misreadings versus actual questions that are dealing with a truth about God that is hard to absorb?
I think for Christians, in my experience, who've come to me with worries about the Bible, it's often around not really knowing how to navigate that. Mm-hmm. And so feeling anxious that if they read something, and I think you guys in earlier episodes of this particular series that I've listened to, you've done a wonderful job of saying, you know, this is what some of these chapters in Genesis are. These are the questions they're trying to answer. These are the questions they're not trying to answer. Mm-hmm. And that often we kind of bring the wrong questions to the text and try to sort of squeeze out the answers that may not be the ones that the original the audience was expecting or the original author was anticipating. And so I think from Christians, it's particular questions like that. Often from non-Christians, I'll just get the question, well, do you take the Bible literally?
Right.
With almost, if I say yes, then it's like, okay, you're one of those fundamentalists. Mm-hmm. If I say, well, sometimes they say, well, you're just a pick and choose person. Like, why would you have this selective reading of the scriptures? And so, you know, trying to walk through with people the fact that actually typically it's clear from the scriptures themselves and from the context whether we should take something as a metaphorically or literally. And that it's not actually hypocritical or inconsistent to treat some passages as literal and others as metaphors. It's actually what we do all day long, even in our normal conversations. And it's certainly what we do with any text.
True. Mm. Rebecca, one thing that I don't think this is the exact language you use, but from your writings that I've gathered, and you mentioned this already once, that one of the things that's important when people are asking hard questions is being the right kind of person, that the kind of person that you just said can say, I don't know. One of the things that I learned early as a pastor, I didn't know I was doing this, but I was saying, I don't know, to questions. Mm. And Kyle, I don't know if you remember this, we would get feedback on some of the learning environments that we were creating at the Village. And that was, for some people, one of the highest values for them when they were giving us feedback. Mm. They said, I've never had a pastor say, I don't know. Yeah. And what happened is, it wasn't just that we were a certain kind of person. It created a certain kind of environment that wasn't like people are used to, kind of Twitter back and forths or hot takes on, you know, cable news channels whenever there's hard issues. But if you can create an environment where you can have a conversation, whether it's hard questions in Genesis or hard questions in life, where there can be a genuine back and forth, I don't know that there's a better environment to create for learning for both people, yeah, for both partners. But what I find is when hard questions are asked, sometimes it really isn't to learn. It's to try to prove a point. Like, you're asking a question to prove a point. But if you can say, I don't know the answer to that, but let's find out together, that automatically dismantles people's maybe aggressive nature that sometimes they're entering these conversations. And you can actually then have an opportunity to create real learning for both the person that's asking the question and yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I feel like I feel like a lot of times when somebody has these serious questions, they're, I don't know if this is y'all's experience, but I feel oftentimes the question for them is high stakes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and you almost just need to de-escalate a little bit. I mean, that may sound strange to say, but just by saying, like, you know what, like, I'm not quite certain, or I'm unsure, or I don't know, or let's explore this together, or maybe consider this, are all very faithful ways of trying to not lower the stakes, so to speak, but certainly not try to mirror, like, you've got this urgency that this question must be answered right now on your terms in the way that you want it to be answered. And I'm almost 100% sure that I'm not going to be able to deliver at that high level of expectation.
Mm-hmm. I just add to that, Kurt, I think there are situations where the right thing to do is de-escalate, like you're describing. Mm-hmm. I think there are others where actually the right thing to do is to escalate, but to do so from the same side of the table as them. Mm. So sometimes if I'm doing a Q&A, and especially I try to ask non-believers or those who have disagreed with a lot of what I've said to speak first. And a question will come, and what I'll typically do if it's a hard question is I will first say, you know, that's an extremely important question. And then I want to say something like, every single person in this room should care about that question.
Yeah.
Like, how can we believe in a loving God in the face of all of this suffering? How can we believe? So almost to take their question and to fill it out, to make it the biggest and best and strongest and most devastating question it could be, mm-hmm, before we then bring the scriptures resources to it. Because then We're validating the fact, I mean, obviously it depends on the question, but we're validating the fact, if it is an important ICT6 question in which they are personally invested, we're saying, yeah, we think this matters too. Yeah. We think this is a real and important issue.
That's really good. Mm-hmm.
And having really understood that, we then will look at what the scriptures say,
mm-hmm,
rather than just going for the immediate, yeah, that doesn't matter because of this, or here's my glib answer. Yeah. But anything that we can do to get ourselves on the same side of the table as the questioner, because we all know, and we see this politically, but we see this in every other domain as well. If people don't feel like you're in the same tribe as them, they're not going to listen to you.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, Rebecca, lots of hard questions emerge from the first 11 chapters of Genesis, but one of the most challenging for believers, typically for most believers, is around creation. So, like, I mean, how do you talk about the doctrine of creation with seekers and skeptics? Like, where do you start with them? If they come to you with a question about the origins of the world, I'm not asking, like, these are like snowflakes. Everybody's is going to be a little bit different, but I guess just broadly, what would be some things that you'd want to make sure I really focus on?
Mm. People tend to assume that modern science is essentially an alternative hypothesis to belief in a creator God. And that, yeah, the more that science has won, the more that belief in a creator God has lost. And that we Christians, we're sort of, it's like standing on the sandcastle at the beach as wave after wave of scientific gravity washes over us, and the carbon gets smaller and smaller, but we're still standing there, you know, as if it's holding together. When you actually look at the history of science, you realize that rather than being an alternative to belief in a creator God, the first modern scientists developed what we now see as the modern scientific method because they believed in a creator God who was both rational and free. So there's a guy named Hans Helveson, who's a professor at Princeton University, and he's one of the top philosophers of science in the world. He was the person from whom I you know, properly learned this. And he said, you know, the folks who were originally crafting what we now assume to be normal in terms of scientific discovery, they knew from the Bible that God had created the world, and they knew that he was a rational, law-making God. And so they thought, huh, I wonder if the universe that God made runs according to rational, consistent laws. Mm-hmm. But then they also realized that the God of the Bible is completely free, and so he could have created the universe any way he liked. And therefore, the only way to find out what these laws undergirding the universe are is to actually go and look.
Mm-hmm.
So we see at the beginning, the birth of what we now see as science came out of theism. Mm. And Hans Helveson, again, as one of probably the top four philosophers of science in the world, he says that even today, theism gives us a better philosophical foundation for science than atheism. In fact, atheism doesn't give you a philosophical foundation for science at all.
That's right.
So I think often starting there with folks who have kind of assumed that science has discredited the idea of a creator God is helpful just in terms of reframing the conversation. And then even looking kind of morally at the things that we learn from Genesis 1 to 3, there are so many things that today are assumed to be self-evident, you know, partly because of the Declaration of Independence of this country. So many truths that are assumed to be self-evident that actually are specifically Christian truths that mm-hmm. come to us from the creation passages.
So you feel like, I think that one of the things that's fascinating about a lot of conversations I have around creation and Christian origins is that exactly what you said is, whether it's implicit or explicit, there's this idea that science, whatever that is, it's almost often treated like it's like some codified book somewhere, right? Like it's an, like that, like exists, and everything that's discovered is added to this book, and this is, it's all agreed upon by anybody who's not suckered in by religious impulses or mythology. But okay, science has just kind of thrown out all that stuff. We don't need any of that stuff. We've just got, I believe in science. I was talking with somebody a couple of days ago in my neighborhood, and they're like, yeah, I'm not really religious, I'm more scientific. And I was like, well, what do you mean? What do you mean when you say that you're more scientific? Like, does that mean that you test everything? You believe in some other defined body of knowledge somewhere? So if somebody just told, like, was just an average listener of Knowing Faith, and they have somebody that they are trying to share the gospel with, and that person just tells them very broadly, oh, I can't believe Christianity because, you know, science. Mm. What would you, like, what would be the next step for you with somebody like that? Like, how would you encourage them to be like, okay, tell me more about what you believe about specific things, or broadly, how do you assess truth claims in the world? I mean, how would you kind of counsel them or coach them to talk about that?
Yeah, I think always to ask questions to understand more of what somebody believes. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about where many people stand today is that on the one hand, they cling firmly to science as the only real arbiter of universal truth, truth that's true whether or not you believe in it, truth that's, you know, true everywhere and every place. So they have that in their one hand. And in the other hand, they're grasping onto things like Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. racism is wrong, the Holocaust should never have happened, men and women are equal. Things that require us to have a different set of tools than science can give us.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading a book by Yuval Noah Harari, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, which came out a few years ago. It's been this massive global bestseller. And one of the really interesting things about it is, you know, he's writing as an atheist Israeli historian and claiming to give us the sort of real scientific and sociological and historical view of Homo sapiens in the course of their development to where we are today. And he'll say things like, human beings have no natural rights, just as spiders, hyenas, and chimpanzees have no natural rights. You know, he'll say that the scientific study of Homo sapiens has embarrassingly little to do with the idea of universal human rights and equal human value. He says that human rights are in fact a Christian fiction. So all of these moral claims that at least my non-Christian friends hold to be self-evident or at least objectively true. It's not just like racism is wrong is my opinion, and if yours is different, that's fine. It's like, no, right. these are real objective mm-hmm. truths that are true mm-hmm. whether or not you or I believe in them. Not only have no foundation in science, but they're actually quite they're at odds with what people believe if they hold a totally naturalistic view on the basis of science. Now, I think the other way to go with that I think we should avoid is to say, well, because some scientists, you know, the Richard Dawkinses of the world, claim that science has proved a naturalistic world where there is no God and there is no creation, we shouldn't buy into that, actually. I think we should lay claim of science as a ultimately a Christian practice. But to say that whereas, you know, science can tell us lots of really useful and interesting things about who we are as humans, there are really important questions that it's not designed to answer. Mm-hmm. And actually, we need to look to the scriptures to answer those questions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not just we can look to the scriptures, but that the answers we'll find there are actually pretty coherent and persuasive.
Yeah. And that, you know, if I think about myself, from a scientific point of view, you could say, well, I'm a mammal. And that's true. I mean, I've got three kids to prove that I meet all the criteria from which you deduce that some being is a mammal. There's no part of me that isn't a mammal. It's not like as Christians, we need to sort of find that physical piece of me that doesn't fit with the mammal idea. I'm scientifically only atoms and molecules. There's not a sort of special spiritual part of me that you could deduce, like examine through the scientific method. But none of these things mean that I am not also a beloved child of God made in his mm-hmm. image and redeemed by the blood of Christ. Like those, I think sometimes as Christians, we've tried to sort of chip away at scientific explanations as if we're sort of trying to find that little space for God rather than saying, do you know what? God is in charge of the whole show. God mm-hmm. actually created every inch of me. God made me as a mammal, but not just as a mammal. He also called me into relationship with him.
Yeah. And that's precisely what we're seeing in the creation account is this psychosomatic unity that God is creating the whole person and that this there is not these false dichotomies that maybe are kind of blown out in the science and religion conversation, mm-hmm. either regardless of what way you're driving on that street. So if you were going to sit down, Rebecca, and read Genesis with a non-Christian, How would you do that? I mean, like, genuinely, if you're like, hey, let's do a Bible, like somebody's like, I've got you. So they accept your invitation to read the book of Genesis with you. How would you actually do that? Mm. I mean, and I mean, like, be as detailed as you want to be.
I would start at the beginning.
Good answer. That's a good place to start.
Honestly, so I think what I would do with a non-Christian, and this is just me, so I'm not saying this is how everybody should do it, but this, for sure. given who I am and how I operate, what I would probably do is I would start at the beginning and I would read Genesis in the light of other potential accounts of why the world is as it is and who we are within it. So I would actually have them read something like You'll Know Harari's Sapiens or Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion. And I would say, because I think often not only are we coming to the Genesis text with not quite the right questions or thinking that it's going to answer the wrong sorts of questions, different sorts of questions than it does, but we're not actually recognizing what the alternative is. And I think for a lot of secular folk today, they think that there is a perfectly coherent secular worldview that does all the work that Christianity does for us without them having to believe in crazy things like this, you know, God who made the world and this man who rose from the dead 2,000 years ago, like all this crazy Christian stuff. What they don't realize is that there is not a compelling alternative that supports the things that they most deeply believe without having to reference Christian things.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, working through I obviously start with Genesis 1 and read it with them and ask them, you know, what do you see here? Right. And kind of start with their reactions and have a conversation on the basis of that. But I would want to bring in, I would want to kind of keep referencing the fact that this is telling a story which, you know, I know you guys covered this in an earlier episode. For the first hearers, it was a story that was in contrast to mm-hmm. other creation narratives and other explanations of why humans are like they are. For us today, those aren't our alternatives in our mental worlds, but there are alternative stories.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I want to run those stories in parallel and see how each of them cashes out.
Do you ever come across something and think, hey, where was that when I was a kid? See, that's what Kaleidoscope is for us. It's perfect for kids ages 6 through 12. Let me tell you more. As a parent, you want to give your kids helpful, faithful, biblical resources as early as you can. But eventually, kids grow out of storybook Bibles, and they've read them a million times. So what's next? Jumping straight into an adult translation is a huge leap, and most of them are written at a high school level or higher, and kids can find them boring, cumbersome, just simply too much. What's a parent to do with that tricky in-between stage to keep kids engaged in studying God's Word? Well, that's where Kaleidoscope comes in. They help bridge the gap between storybook Bibles and adult translations by retelling every book of the Bible at an elementary reading level in beautifully designed single-volume chapter books. Your kids will learn in words and language they can understand. Kaleidoscope also has volumes on everything from Genesis and Exodus to Mark and Romans, and they even have Yodo cards so you can listen along. Check them out today at readkaleidoscope.com or follow them on Instagram at readkaleidoscope. And listen, if you make an order using the code FAITH, they will take 10% off your order. Again, if you use the code FAITH, they will take 10% off your order. Kaleidoscope is the new kid in kids' Bibles. Check them out at readkaleidoscope.com today. Meet your new favorite study companion. Immerse yourself in both the Old and New Testaments with the Holman Handbooks, brought to you by the Christian Standard Bible. I've got to tell you, I love these handbooks. They contain charts, maps, word studies, and more for each book of the Bible. They are some of my most used resources whenever I'm studying a passage. They intersect beauty, goodness, and truth, and they're designed to last a lifetime as a valuable resource for Bible study, teaching, and ongoing discipleship. They're available in two different cover options for each. Buy one, get one free at lifeway.com with the promo code HandbookBogo. Again, that is HandbookBogo on lifeway.com in order to get some of these Holman handbooks, HandbookBogo, Handbook BOGO on lifeway.com for these Holman handbooks. They are fantastic resources.
Yeah.
I have a question though. Doug, Kyle set you up because we've been doing a series on Genesis to say if you sat down to read Genesis with an unbeliever, but there are a lot of opinions out there on where you should start in the scriptures with someone who's a skeptic. And I'm curious what you would, outside of our Genesis requirements for this podcast today, where would you take someone? I'm asked that question a lot. I'm curious what your response would be.
I actually want to hear everybody's answer to this question. That's a really interesting question. But yeah, Rebecca, why don't you kick us off?
If you'd asked me a decade ago what my favorite gospel was, I would definitely have said John. Mm-hmm. Like, I have a long-term love affair with John's gospel. Today, I think I might read Luke with somebody first. And the reason is, Luke's incredible, right? We all know that. But Luke is the gospel that most focuses on and prioritizes the weak and marginalized and women. And I think for a lot of my contemporaries, you know, secular friends and contemporaries today, a lot of the questions about Christianity are actually less about questions of origins and science, et cetera, and more sort of deeply moral questions where they assume that Christianity is on the side of, you know, the white male chauvinism and against all other things. And I think Luke's gospel just walks us so beautifully through Jesus's care for the poor, weak and marginalized, his love for women, and the ways in which he truly changed the world in his teaching as well as in his death and resurrection. So I today would walk through Luke with somebody, but I would be torn because I also would really want to read John with him.
Those are great. Kyle, what would you say?
Yeah, it would be Matthew. And I would have said very similar to Rebecca 10 years ago. I would have definitely said Gospel of John. And actually, that's how I was like taught to read the Bible with like a new believer or a non-Christian person. It was like John. But after doing that a lot, I found myself going to Matthew a ton. And I think partly with you right out of the gate with Matthew, you get son of David, son of Abraham. Mm-hmm. So you get to go all the whole story. And then when you get into Matthew, particularly the Sermon on the Mount, I think that if you can tee that up the right way, then you get to get this whole story of like, yes, this is this great teacher and he has some incredible things to say, but this is the Lord speaking. This is God speaking to us and giving us his vision for his kingdom. And so I have found much more fruitfulness in going through the Gospel of Matthew than I ever did going through the Gospel of Luke. But for much the same reason, Rebecca, that you mentioned regarding your transition from John to Luke, is that I think that some of the ethical components are just a little bit more pronounced in Luke and Matthew than they are in John. But Matthew is typically where I go now.
Jennifer?
I would say Matthew, but only because I'm more familiar with Matthew than I am with Luke. I've spent more time there. I think it'd be a toss-up for me between those two, though. I think Rebecca, you have some really good reasons to go with Luke, but for me, I'm on a firmer footing in Matthew just because I spent more time there, and I like the fulfillment theme in Matthew so much. I think it can be helpful, but again, when you're dealing with someone who thinks the whole thing is fakey, don't know the fulfillment is that strong of an argument. I am surprised at John being the first choice for so many because at bare minimum, it's not synoptic. And so I think it's hard for people to follow what's
Did
going
you just,
on.
Like, downgrade the
Well, can I have a coda to this?
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys ever have sort of theological or Bible crushes where there's like a passage or a particular chapter you just can't talk about enough. So John 11, the raising of Lazarus, my friends laugh at me because I'd be like, I was talking with a friend today and I got to have some gospel conversation with them. They'd be like, guess where you went in the Bible? I was like, yes, I went to John 11 again. I'm sorry. But it's just so stunning. So I think maybe what I do is Luke with a side serving of John. And those conversations with women, like the woman at the well, Martha, and the keeping of Lazarus's death. It's just so powerful.
I get that. And mine would be my thing I can't stop talking about is the Sermon on the Mount. So that's why I keep getting dragged. And I'm like, Sermon on the Plain, sure. But why did you shorten it, Luke? Come on, like give us the whole thing. But it is really true that you do have your spaces that you've just been drawn to over and over again. And those are the ones. I mean, I think that's a good point for those who are listening. And JT hasn't answered yet, so we want to give him a chance. And I know he loves the Gospel of John, so he's probably going to say that. But you should trust your instinct based on where the Lord has drawn you repeatedly, and know that your most authoritative voice, maybe that's not, or even your most pastoral or compassionate voice is going to come out of the passages that you have had to deal with the most, the longest.
Bingo. Yeah, bingo. I agree with that 100%.
JT, what's your answer?
My fake answer is Ecclesiastes.
Oh, you're the worst.
Vanity of vanity. Life is vanity. Can't we all agree there? No, my answer is John, and primarily for John 13 to 17. That's an area I've just spent a lot of time both in academic work, but also just in personal work, just abiding in the Lord and abiding in Jesus, and then inter-Trinitarian relationships and how we get to enter into that and the oneness of fellowship with God. So yeah, for me, it's nostalgic. That's the passage that I went to when I became a Christian in college as a freshman. Campus Crusade said, go read John. I read it like 17 times that month. And so it's just, that's my happy place.
Yeah. Well, keeping it beyond Genesis right now, since we got there, we dove in and we dove back out, which is good. And I anticipated we would do that. What would you say, Rebecca, to kind of land the plane here? What would you say to someone who's listening to this, who has doubts about the goodness or truthfulness of God's word and God's creation? Like, maybe they just are like, I don't like the idea that God designed humanity as men and women. Like, I just, I don't like that. Or I don't like how God has structured that. Or I don't like that God was sovereign over a world in which brokenness or sin was allowed, ordained, or permitted. These are things, and like, what would you just say to somebody who's like, I have doubts around this? How would you encourage them?
Rebecca, can I like add like a caveat to that question? Because I wanted to ask you this earlier. Sure. I didn't get a chance. And if you can weave these things together, great. That's what I'm hoping you can do. But Kyle just said something that triggered a question I wanted to ask you. Like, one of the one of the challenges that I feel like I face, that I'm trying to learn how to do it in an appropriate way with perhaps my secular friends or my neighbors, colleagues who are asking the kinds of questions that Kyle just asked, is I'm trying to find generous and humble ways to show them that the reason they're asking that question is because they're living on the exhaust fumes of a Judeo-Christian worldview.
Yeah.
Like, even as you just said about Luke, like the whole point about caring for the marginalized, the weak, the oppressed, you know, whatever, is because they've been formed and shaped by the ethical and moral worldview that the Bible gives us, and they're using it to deny the Bible. Does that make sense?
So it makes absolute sense. Yes, okay. Yes. And I think it's an incredibly important thing for us as Christians to understand and for us to communicate graciously to our non-Christian friends. I found, I don't know if you guys have read British historian Tom Holland's book, Dominion, How the Christian, Revolution Remade the World.
Fantastic.
So he, for those who haven't come across him, is a British historian, not a Christian, and gave up believing in God as a kid because he found the Greek and Roman gods far more attractive than this, you know, guy who died on a cross. And he's written this massive popular history of the last 2,000 years of Christianity in the West. And in the course of his research, he discovered that things that today would seem like basic moral common sense, both to me as a Christian and to him as a non-Christian and to, you know, the secular humanist society, are actually specifically Christian truths.
That's right.
So in particular, and I mentioned that the idea of universal human rights, Tom Holland points out that when that was formulated, in the late 1940s, in the sort of aftermath of the horrors of World War II, the fact that it was absolutely drawing on specifically Christian tradition had to be quite carefully disguised for there to be a hope that it would be adopted by a whole bunch of different countries that where Christianity may not be the majority religion.
That's exactly right.
And that sort of repackaging of Christian understandings has been really successful, mm-hmm. which in some sense is good news, mm-hmm. and in another sense is problematic because it means that we, as we talk with our Christian friends now, you know, they also hold it to be self-evident that all men and women are created equal.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever ask them why they believe that?
Yeah, well, they believe that because they've been told that that's just what is.
Right.
It's a truth on which we sort of stake our lives without realizing that it needs to be defended. And I think both what both Yuval Noah Harari and Sapiens does and what Tom Holland does in Dominion from kind of somewhat different angles is expose the fact that our idea that human beings are morally equal, that men and women are fundamentally of equal moral value, that the poor and the weak and the marginalized have any claim to make on the rich and the strong and the powerful. All of these are Christian ideas. And so Tom Holland points out that even in our most fraught conversations around gender and sexuality, for example, both conservative theological Christians and the sort of most progressive secular folk are actually trading with the same terms, thinking, you know, the historically marginalized should be cared for. Mm-hmm. The minority shouldn't be just trampled down by the majority. The strong shouldn't just triumph over the weak. And that's a Christian idea. That's not a self-evident truth.
Mm-hmm. That's really helpful, Rebecca. Mm-hmm. That's good. I've found that it's important when you're asking those questions to ask them humbly, gently, because it can be a disorienting thing for somebody.
Absolutely.
To like, wait a second, you're questioning the very foundation of my morals.
Yeah.
And you're saying that I don't have a basis for why I feel the way that I feel about the disenfranchised, the marginalized, the oppressed. But slowly it's important to show them that other parts of the world do not share those same quote unquote self-evident truths. And there's no basis to think that we will in the West 200 years from now or 500 years from now, unless they are defended and maintained for a specific reason, not just because it's convenient.
Yeah, no, that's totally true.
I wonder if you could leave us, Rebecca, with sort of the attitude that we should go into these conversations with. I mean, we're in a moment in human history where every conversation is about winning or losing, it feels like, or silencing opponents. And when you sat down to help people move toward conversation points around these things, what guidance would you give us about entering into these hard conversations with people who are coming from a place of unbelief?
Yeah, it's so important. I think first, wherever we can, to take the lowest place. and to have a humble posture and to reinforce the fact that we are sinners saved by grace, that Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners, of whom you and I are the foremost, so that we have a sort of moral humility as we approach people, and that we try not to let our own egos get tangled up. I mean, sometimes we think that we're defending Jesus when in fact we're defending our own egos. I had that strong temptation. And when somebody comes with hostility, to meet that with love, because that's what Christians are called to do, you know, to love even our enemies. I think the more that we can do that, the more we can kind of open up that space where we feel like we're on the same side of the table as the other person. Because we're not saying I'm on some moral high ground looking down on you. And people do become disarmed. If people come to you with hostility and you meet them with love, it's a powerful weapon. It's the best and only weapon we really have as Christians, as we engage with others. But it's actually really powerful. And so I think finding ways to agree with the challenge that they've placed before us in the ways that we can, whilst also showing them Jesus and his entirely countercultural and sort of world upturning view of everything, whether it's sort of human power or you know, the route to actual life versus actual death, just to, wherever we can, bring Jesus and his death and resurrection into the center of our conversation. And that's never hard. I feel like there's no kind of apologetics question that gets asked that there isn't a short step to taking them to Jesus at the cross, because that's really the center around which everything else is going to revolve. But doing that so that we're lifting Jesus up even as we lay ourselves down, I think is going to be the best approach.
I love that. Rebecca, let me just say to the audience, if you are not familiar with Rebecca's book, you need to ask Santa for that book for Christmas. It is wow, that good. It's worth getting. Get the book. It's very good. She hasn't asked us to say that. She's probably embarrassed that we keep talking about it.
She's probably worried that you just advocated for a high view of Santa in relation to her book. But
I was obviously being comical. If the listener wants to extrapolate that I believe in Santa, then that's a very uncharitable read. But whatever,
Brad, we're going to need that cut out.
Exactly right. Better put jingle bells behind it and just make it like, let's just go full holidays on it. Well, listen, I'm glad that we've been able to have Rebecca on this show. Honored that you jumped on. And listen, if you've been listening to the show and you want to join the conversation, you can find us on social media at Knowing Faith Podcast. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook that way. If you're not following Rebecca on Twitter, she's a great Twitter follow, and there's very few of those left. So go follow Rebecca on Twitter. If you want to find out more about what's going on with Knowing Faith, you can go to patreon.com/knowingfaith. And our next episode, we will finish up Genesis 1 through 11 by looking, kind of teasing what comes next with the life of Abraham, which we'll cover in the spring. Grace and peace.